I got a little scared when I realized I had to revert to my earlier life this morning at about 10 o'clock when I thought by then I would have the PowerPoint slides ready and, you know, I'd be all set to go. It just doesn't work out that way. A lot of things interfere with your day, but I do want to thank Charles and Menzie for inviting me to be part of this. It was a little bit devilish on their part to do that, I'll be honest. I spoke to a conference they had a couple years ago, and I gave my normal unrepentant speech about the U.S. current account deficit. They know very full well that I don't think our current account deficit is nearly as much of a problem as probably the average reader of a newspaper would think, and probably don't think it's as much of a problem as the average sophisticated economist would think. And so I am now here to ask for forgiveness. No, I'm not. I'm here to talk about how I see things today, which is admittedly a bit different than 2 years ago, certainly. But yeah, I gave that provocative talk in the sense that I explained why I felt our deficit should not really be cause for alarm. So I know they're looking forward to the sequel. I will say as an aside that I'm fortunate that as an international economist, when I give a provocative talk as a university administrator, it's only about goods, services, or assets, which don't actually have feelings. Some academic administrators who have a background in economics get tripped up talking about human beings and labor markets, and I'm glad I won't fall victim to that today. I do want to extend a warm welcome to some academic colleagues that are here that will be on our panels. Shengjin Wei is with us, Catherine Mann, Michael Melvin, and Jeff Frankel, I think, is here.
He is arriving soon.
He's arriving soon. They're a great assembly of talent, a lot of policy and academic experience, very thoughtful people, and you're in for a real treat to hear from them. As Charles mentioned, because of my background, he and I have known each other a long time, and I've known this group of outside speakers for a long time, so it was really a treat to be able to be here today and see them. Kathy Mann and I worked on the same topic when I started doing research as a grad student at Stanford. She was a newly minted PhD from MIT who had been working on goods prices and exchange rates, which is something that I worked on in my thesis, and she was very gracious as a young professional, gave me a lot of feedback. And I was thinking this morning, you know, how long ago was that? And I'll just say this, I didn't email her when I had questions. We talked on the phone. I don't think that would happen now. So anyway, it's great to see Kathy, and it's great to have Michael and Jeff and Shengjin here. I think I met them actually after I was using email, so we don't go back quite as far. Also, great privilege to have so many business people here with us today, and I hope you look forward to the topic of this conference. And so, you know, the main topic is external imbalances and the value of the dollar. I'm going to talk mainly about external imbalances. And my self-defined task in this talk is to move all of the non-academic audience off the prior belief that a current account deficit like we have in the United States today is bad. Because I think, you know, my experience in teaching MBA students, executive MBAs, undergraduate students, is that that's a pretty strongly held prior view. And it makes sense because our current account is a deficit, and if you look up the word deficit in the dictionary, that's got negative connotations. But in fact, in this case, that's not really appropriate. A current account surplus can be an even bigger problem than a deficit. And of course, either of them can be no problem whatsoever, can just be a manifestation of mutually advantageous trade. So I'm gonna try to tackle this challenge by focusing mainly on the U.S. and persuade you that the obviously problematic current account deficit in the world today, the U.S. current account deficit, is not really such a big problem. But let's start by, you know, addressing why it is common wisdom that this is, in fact, a symptom, at least, if not a problem itself, a symptom of some underlying big problems. First of all, it's large. You know, the U.S. current account imbalance has grown, you know, well above 6% of GDP at times. I think now it's sort of back around 6%, although I don't watch the quarterly data as much as I used to. Coincident with that, the savings rate for U.S. households went negative in early 2006. That's a lot of cause for alarm. Looks like U.S. households are out-of-control spenders without any discipline. Of course, I've been reading that story for 20 years. That's a story that's been written about as long as I've been reading that the Japanese will fix their banking system. You know, you just get tired of reading that article after a while. We've always been frivolous consumers, and the Japanese have not really fixed their banking system. But consumption as a share of GDP is near or at all-time highs at this point, about 70% of GDP in consumption, which is very high by historic standards, and that's kind of the flip side of this low saving rate. And then we've had a fiscal deficit, you know, on and off. We had a brief period of surplus under President Clinton, but I think most people would say our fiscal policy today, for a variety of reasons, looks fairly reckless. Spending is high. Some of the spending is on activities that a lot of us don't agree with. And we've had tax cuts at the same time. You know, and at a minimum, maybe we should at least pay for more of our international adventures that we're pursuing today, as opposed to borrowing. So fiscal policy looks reckless. You add all that up, it looks like we're spending a lot, we're not paying the costs currently, and we are, in fact, mortgaging our future. And the current account deficit is a manifestation of that. Okay, so that's the simple story. We spend too much. We save and invest too little. Our firms are not competitive. That would go with this story, the view that U.S. firms aren't competitive, therefore we can't export enough to pay for our imports. And that's sort of the common wisdom, that we're mortgaging our future. You know, we're basically kind of nuts, and we have a few opportunities to borrow, I guess, from people who will, in fact, lend to us, and then we proceed to spend on useless things. So that sort of fits in with Warren Buffett's view of the world. You know, Buffett thinks that we are a nation of spendthrifts. And, you know, I will grant, for the last 2 or 3 years, we have certainly been bigger spendthrifts than we ought to have been, and I'll come to that in a minute. So up to that point, 2 or 3 years ago, I certainly didn't have the view that we were out-of-control spenders, and I didn't have the view that this current account deficit was such a bad thing, and so I want to try to explain why. You know, first, I'd ask everyone to remember that current account deficits by their nature aren't good or bad, even though the term deficit itself has negative connotations. It's easy for a layperson to forget, that's what I wrote when I was first writing this talk, but maybe in fact most lay people would never really think about the fact that in the first place, it's important to remember cross-border flows between U.S. and foreign residents have to be of equal value. For every buyer, there's a seller for every transaction. So when you add up the aggregate of all international transactions that go on between U.S. residents and foreign residents, they're balanced, okay? So our overall international imbalance, or I'm sorry, our overall international balance has two offsetting imbalances, one of them in trade in goods and services and the other in trade in assets. So they cancel each other out. So we have to think about it from the starting point of there's a whole lot of international transactions today. Every transaction presumably made both parties better off, or they wouldn't have done it. These are all voluntary exchanges, remember. But what's happened is journalists arrived at the scene and said, well, when you parcel them out into goods and services trade and assets trade, this one's out of balance, and you know that's consistent with us not being competitive, so this is a bad thing. Journalists should have to do more work than that to persuade you that our current account deficit is a bad thing. Every single transaction made both parties better off. So we have to tell a more complicated story about why a current account deficit is bad. So in a global economy with trade in goods and assets, the financial market should allocate capital in order to equalize returns across countries. That's a very important principle of international economics. So the point of rest of the economic system is not one that guarantees current accounts are going to have a zero balance. It guarantees that the rate of return on investment should be equalized in expectation by these cross-border capital flows. Okay? So that's really the equilibrium condition, and there may be quite large imbalances that exist in that. So what characterizes a country with a current account deficit in this kind of international equilibrium? It's a country that, in the absence of trade, would have had a very high internal return on investment. So a country that would have, without trade, really attractive investment opportunities that were not pursued at the margin because there wasn't enough capital to undertake them. Meanwhile, you'll have other countries in that equilibrium without trade that might have a very low marginal return on investment activity, but they need to invest a lot because they're trying to provide for their future. And they feel, for whatever reason, they're going to need a lot of resources in the future. So what happens is, in a world with trade, foreign investment seeks out those projects that might not have been undertaken in a high return economy and foregoes those projects that were being undertaken in a lower return economy in the pursuit of better returns for the investors in that country to provide for their future income. So we shouldn't think of a trade deficit inherently as a bad thing. Now, that doesn't mean our trade deficit is a good thing or we shouldn't worry about it, but I want people to keep that in mind, especially our business audience and some of our students as they think about the panel discussions today. So the next thing I want to say is I want to make a few remarks about why I think the United States is a quote-unquote natural candidate to have a current account deficit right now, even if markets are functioning well, people have good information, and they're rational decision makers. Okay, so in a world without distortions to people's choice, why might we expect the U.S. to be a net exporter of assets and a net importer of goods and services today? Well, if you look at our economy over the last 15 or 20 years, you would note that compared to other developed economies, we've had a pretty good run in terms of GDP growth. We've had a fairly high growth trajectory relative to other developed countries in Europe or Japan. Why is that? Well, one of the reasons our GDP growth ticked up, and you certainly see this after 1995, is that the underlying growth in productivity in our economy seems to have undergone a bit of a level shift, up by almost, say, 40% relative to what the steady state had been in the prior decade. That's the best kind of GDP growth you can have. I think people put way too much stock, by the way, in GDP numbers when you look across countries. So even though we might feel good that our GDP growth rates have been higher than Japan in the last 15 or 20 years, their labor force growth rate hasn't been high enough to support very high growth in GDP. So, you know, you have to be careful. And, you know, I even think this idea that, you know, recession is when an economy falls below, you know, 0% GDP growth in real terms. It's, you know, that while that's not the technical definition NBER uses alone, it's something that everyone attaches a lot of significance to. But the steady state rate of GDP growth is driven in large part by just how fast your working age population is growing. And so Japan has just been in a bad situation lately that way. But their productivity growth, which was astounding in the 60s and 70s, hasn't been all that great in the 90s and in this decade. So underlying productivity growth has been kind of a very positive development going on under the surface of the U.S. economy for about the last at least 13 years. Over the last 15 years, there's been very healthy growth in the market value of companies in the United States. The stock market, although there have been large corrections at times, and we've had one recently, if you look over the last, you know, since 1991, say, very healthy growth in the value of capital in this country. Wealth has been hovering, you know, for the economy as a whole. Households' net worth is hovering near its all-time highs, or was until recent corrections, but it's still higher than average as a share of household disposable personal income. Okay? So households actually look quite wealthy in terms of their financial wealth, their housing wealth, etc., relative to their disposable personal income. And that had been going on kind of rising steadily since about 1995 with that productivity growth, and then certainly may have been exaggerated somewhat the last couple years by the housing boom, but we'll see where that settles out. And that's important because when people look at the decline in savings rates and the increase in consumption, those are typically measured when they're reported in the media relative to current income without any reference to wealth. So when a reporter called me when we finally got our first observation of negative savings rates and wanted me to pile on and say we were going to hell in a handbasket, she was taken aback when I said, "Why do you think people save?" And she said, "Well, because maybe their kids have to go to college or they're saving for retirement, etc." And I said, "Well, okay, yeah, so they're trying to build up wealth." I said, "Why don't you look at, you know, the same organization that puts out the savings rate measures wealth as a share of disposable personal income. Why don't you look at that?" And when you look at that point, you saw it was at an all-time high. So people are consuming a lot out of current income because they don't feel at that point like they need to set aside a lot of that current income because maybe their equity returns and growth in home equity had exceeded their expectations and they thought, you know, I've got enough stored away. Now, maybe it'll turn out they were wrong. We'll find out. And certainly, they're revising their expectations as we speak, and we'll see some changes in that behavior. But, you know, it remains to be seen how big the housing bubble was and whether there was, you know, an associated equity price bubble at the same time. A lot of the micro evidence on saving behavior, and some published by Charles's colleagues in the economics department, suggests that most households, if you look at their saving behavior and their wealth accumulation with reference to normal replacement rates of income that people want at retirement, are saving enough for retirement. So, and I'm sure we can find some studies that go the other way. I do put a lot of stock in some of that micro evidence. So there aren't that many households by many studies estimates that find themselves without adequate wealth stored up for their future needs. So that's a perspective that I kind of take on this. While we certainly overhyped the notion of a new economy in the late 1990s, it remains true that the formation of knowledge industries that grew out of advances in telecommunications, computing, and the development of the internet has really been a significant development, not only for the new businesses that were created in that space, but for the ability of those knowledge economy industries to drive productivity in other industries as people adopt those technologies. And the United States is sort of uniquely positioned to capitalize on those types of gains in other related industries, precisely because we have more flexible labor markets and we have broader and deeper capital markets. So we've been able to reinvent ourselves in place a little more effectively because of our capital market structure, I would argue, compared to a lot of other more advanced economies. And the thing I like to think about there, you know, who would believe at this point, if you had told us in the late 1980s that there'd be all these developments in telecommunications, computing, and the internet, that Japan would not be on the forefront of that? I mean, we were so worried about them making chips in the late 80s and all these other things. They're getting into electronics. But it never really happened. Things never got traction there in the same way. And I think the reason is our capital markets really are broad and deep. And they support firms at all levels, especially young firms. And so something I like to look at is if you look at the list of the biggest market cap companies in America, look at that list today and then go back and look at it 30 years ago, and you'll find in 30 years' time half of those companies are gone and they're replaced by companies that 30 years ago we would have never even heard of. I mean, the idea that companies like Oracle, Google, Microsoft are as big and worth as much as they are as quickly as they are is astounding. It just doesn't happen in very many parts of the world. So our ability, our capital markets' ability to support that kind of growth and development is a very important feature of our economy, and I think that's something that I certainly hang my hat on. Now, another thing that's true about our economy is labor markets are a little more flexible than labor markets in other developed countries. So how do you take advantage of these new technologies? Well, it actually takes a lot of restructuring and reorganization of the workplace to move to the adoption of a lot of these technologies in how we get things done. Whether you're a service business or a manufacturing company, you can use computing, the internet, telecommunications to change how you do things. And companies in this country have embraced that and done that more effectively, and I think that's the second thing that's driving our productivity resurgence. So these productivity gains have driven income growth. They've increased confidence about future incomes for many workers and households and increased the values of many firms in the economy. And so these increases in income and wealth, while quite uneven by recent standards, and you know, I'm not going to go on about income distribution, but that is a looming issue in our economy today, to which I think education is an important part of the solution. But these increases in income and wealth explain the qualitative relationships that I see in the macro variables today. Whether the current account deficit is actually too big is certainly a matter of debate, and I would agree that over the last several years, it's been bigger than it should be for some very particular reasons having to do with mortgage origination and lax credit standards. But the fact that we have a current account deficit does not shock me at all. We are a natural candidate for a current account deficit because of these reasons. I liken it to the kind of qualitative relationships between macro variables, and by that I mean savings rates, current account balance, capital account balance, investment, consumption as a share of GDP. It's like when Norway discovered oil in the North Sea. The minute they discovered oil, they knew they were wealthier, and it affected people's behavior. It affected investment behavior. Capital pours in because they got to extract that oil. But people weren't waiting for the oil to come out of the ground. They knew their future taxes would probably go down. They knew that they had a brighter economic future, so they start consuming right away. So consumption goes up as a share of GDP. Where do you get the investment capital? You borrow it from abroad. And I actually think at some level, the productivity revolution that's happened in the U.S., especially over the last 12 or 13 years, has led to the same types of behavior unfolding over a longer period of time. And I don't want our audience to think, you know, the typical worker in the U.S. economy is walking around thinking about, geez, we've got higher productivity growth, I can spend more. They're not thinking that. But a lot of people find themselves working at a company or in an industry or an occupation where they feel inherently very confident about their future earnings prospects. And those kind of people spend money. And I think that's what we're seeing unfold in our economy. All right, so I've now given you my positive scenario, and I want to mention a few reasons why this optimistic story might be wrong. The first one that we've heard a lot is that we're a nation of irrational consumers. We want it now. We have no discipline in our household spending. As I said earlier, you know, we've been hearing that for a long time. I thought American consumers were always frivolous, and so I refuse to believe that that's a new development. Okay. I do want to say that our deficit position with respect to the current account, those imbalances have been bigger than they should be the last few years because of lax credit conditions that certainly emanated from mortgage origination but spread more widely throughout our financial system. But this add-on to domestic consumption and trade imbalances is fairly recent. That game is up. A correction is underway. We will see how big and deep that correction is. I don't expect it's going to be, I don't expect it's going to get a lot worse than it is now. I think the recovery period for the economy will be drawn out. It'll be a slow recovery. Really, the last several recoveries from recessions in this country have been quite slow, but the recessions have been much shallower than the typical post-World War II recession, and I think that's what we'll see in this case as well. Another reason our current account deficit might be bigger than it should be is that people may overestimate their future income for a couple reasons. One having to do with policy. We may overestimate our future income because we're overestimating how much of a Social Security safety net is going to be there for us 20 years from now or 30 years from now. So that may lead some households, if they're overestimating what the government's payout will be to them in retirement, they may not be saving enough to supplement that for the needs that they will have. So I worry a little bit about that form of overestimation. People may also be overestimating the growth in their incomes going forward. So maybe all these people at these new economy companies are thinking the party's going to go on forever. Maybe it won't go on forever. Maybe pretty soon some German, Japanese, other, you know, companies from other countries are going to get in the game and compete away some of these returns and drive down wages. That's a pretty natural process. I think that will happen, but I don't think that's going to happen suddenly. When I talk to people who are in those sectors, they still have a hard time identifying who the companies are in Germany, Japan, other European countries that are really going to materialize as major threats to the market position of some of our new economy businesses. On the labor side, there may be more outsourcing of certain activities, and that may put pressure on wages at certain in certain occupations. I don't have a good handle on how big that problem might be, so I wouldn't want to predict that. So, you know, those are some of the things that I think I worry about, that we've overestimated our future prospects, and so maybe we're consuming too much for that reason. And certainly over the last few years, people were able to obtain credit more easily than they should, so a lot of credit-constrained households probably did overspend, and there's going to be a lot of, you know, restructuring that has to go on in the housing market. Longer term, I certainly think our deficit position will narrow because this bull run won't last forever and because there will be a correction to these recent excesses. But I still think we're going to be a deficit country for a while. And a reason I haven't really mentioned yet, I think we think a lot about flows as economists, and we often don't think enough about stocks. And I do think that, you know, globalization is a process. It isn't going to happen overnight. And we're in a world that is globalizing in the sense that borders mean less and less, it seems, year after year. And as countries, when countries entered this beginning phase of globalization, they had very different balance sheets, in a sense. And the United States is a country that I like to think of as, it had a very attractive balance sheet. In particular, has incredibly attractive real estate. And if we really are, you know, headed toward a world where borders don't matter, population density is going to even out. And there's going to be a lot of demand for U.S. real estate from foreign residents. So just in terms of land value, you know, I would expect there's going to be continued upward pressure on that. And as you're selling off hard assets like that, what are you going to do with it? You're probably going to spend it on consumption. I don't know a lot of Americans who are going to turn around and invest it in real estate in Japan or in Europe. That's not where I see people buying vacation homes. I think the U.S., Australia, South Africa share this feature in common, that you will see over time that more and more foreign residents will be serious landholders in those countries, and that generates a certain financial windfall, and it'll take a long time for that process to play out. So while that's unfolding, I think there's just a natural drag on the current account that takes it into deficit. So long term, though, I think that process will slow. I think our deficit position will narrow because our productivity growth surge will flatten out at a certain point. The things that worry me most, you know, about our economy aren't really with respect to international imbalances. I think we have an economy that was built because of our low population density and then policies that have reinforced that, conditional on a pretty low price of oil and gas and carbon fuels and energy in general. And I think we're not very well positioned for a high energy price world in terms of our housing stock and our transportation infrastructure, and that's going to be a real problem for our economy going forward. I'm not a big fan of Senator McCain's summer gas tax holiday. I think that's just, you know, for someone who takes as strong a stand as he does against special interest, I see that as a policy that is absolute political pandering. It plays to a very large audience. It helps a lot of people a little bit, and it gives us exactly the wrong signal about the long-term adjustments that we need to make as a country. I think the recent episode is going to have a couple of longer-term negative consequences, the recent episode in mortgage lending and financial excesses. I think it is going to erode confidence in the dollar as a reserve currency. I think that has probably been digested in the markets already, and in fact, probably we've overshot the steady-state level of the value of the dollar. But I've been saying the dollar is going to strengthen for 2 or 3 years now. So you don't invest on that. Don't trade on that forecast. I don't. Okay. I think another important consequence is that it may well damage credibility of a very important service export industry in the United States, and that's investment banking. Investment banks were very involved in recycling these mortgage products that buyers certainly didn't fully understand, and it seems like maybe some of the investment banks didn't fully understand because they got caught with a lot of them on their books. And I think everybody is very suspicious of what their motives were. I think it damages credibility, and that's really the most valuable asset an investment bank can have. And whenever one of your big service industries is damaged like that, that's not going to be a good thing for the U.S. long term. So, and then I think the last thing that worries me on the policy front about our future, a lot of this productivity growth and creation of knowledge economy companies was aided by U.S. immigration policy, by letting really talented people who want to pursue an advanced degree come into this country, pursue that degree, and then many of them end up working here. A lot of our math and science graduate students in the United States, it's no secret, are foreign nationals, and many of them would like to stay here. That's getting harder and harder, and those people feed our knowledge economy, and we all benefit from that, and I think we need to be very careful in how we think about immigration policy. I would say that's the biggest threat to our competitive advantage in the knowledge industries, and I think that competitive advantage in that space is really key to our future growth opportunities. So those are the things that really worry me most. I don't worry about trade deficits per se, but I think there are some ancillary issues in our economy that do keep me awake at night. So I hope all of you will enjoy our panelists today and have a great discussion. I've got a little time. I can take some questions if you have them, but thank you very much. Class dismissed. Charles?
I'll ask you a question. So I'd like to contrast your view with Martin Feldstein, president of the National Bureau of Economic Research, who just this week came out with an article that argued, both you and he agree that our exports are going to go up. His view is that it's got to be a weak dollar, and it's got to make our products cheap for foreigners. And I think your view, if I can characterize it correctly, is that we're an innovative economy. We're producing new things that people want to buy. Mm-hmm. Is that fair? And I guess the question is, where do you feel like over the next, what sectors over the next, say, 10 years or 20 years are we going to be exporting?
So I don't disagree with his point. I think... I don't think so. A lot of what we export today are products that may not have a lot of close competition, and margins are in fact pretty high. These knowledge economy products have a lot of intellectual capital associated with them and very high margins. And so I think on the other hand, the weaker dollar just makes those margins bigger. So all those sales, we certainly have more pricing leverage in local currencies, or the same pricing leverage in the local currency, and that means more dollars coming back into our economy that we're probably using to pay for oil imports right now. So I think it's an important part of the dynamic that will help us grow exports, and also, we're in an agricultural state to some degree, although we just agreed at the table there's not a lot of farm income generated here, but there are a lot of cash flows associated with agricultural exports still. and also with agricultural sales domestically. And so I think a weaker dollar certainly helps, you know, what farm income is in this country. So we still do a fair amount of exporting there. And import competition isn't quite as stiff. So for all those reasons, I mean, I think a weak dollar still does advantage U.S. producers, all else equal, because prices just don't adjust as quickly as currency values do. So I would agree with Feldstein on that, but I still think the thing that I watch for the long-term health of our economy is, do we see competitive pressure springing up in those sectors where we've developed a pretty healthy advantage and where we do get really high returns on human and physical capital? And those are the knowledge industries. We still dominate them right now, and I don't, you know, I don't know how long that will last. But Catherine?
At the very beginning of your talk, you argued that every transaction is a voluntary transaction between the two parties, and I'll agree with that 100%. Except for many of the financial transactions, the majority of the financial transactions that, in other words, the manner in which the U.S. borrows on international markets, the proportion of the financial inflows that are due to official parties, either directly under the aegis of the government entity or under the aegis of sovereign wealth funds, those financial flows have become increasingly important over the last 2 years. And I wonder if you would comment on the extent to which the voluntary nature of the transactions, of which a lot of your argument about the deficit
sure.
is not bad, that's based on those transactions being voluntary, market-driven mm-hmm. transactions. And to the extent that these parties out there perhaps behave somewhat differently than a truly private, small entity would.
They may. So I'm sure they would behave differently. So basically, you know, I would reinterpret that as there are some very large players in this market. I think what they're doing at this point is still voluntary. I don't know that you're questioning that, but you're saying maybe they don't face as strong a bottom line incentive where they feel compelled to do this and they have other alternatives. I don't doubt that there are a lot of reasons why foreign governments probably don't like us as much today on average as they did 8 years ago. And I think that at some level that will lead people to make different choices about reserve currencies, et cetera, and that could put more pressure on the dollar, and it'll have to guide monetary policy adjustments. Whether that'll be a huge deal, I don't know. You know, and certainly we've seen sovereign wealth funds come to the aid of the U.S. financial sector, so we are selling off chunks of that sector. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. We've sold off chunks of our country before and chunks of industries, and sometimes it works out well for foreign buyers, sometimes it doesn't. So I'm certainly not going to say that the fact that government flows are a part of the story and that sovereign funds are big players in the market invalidates the notion that transactions are voluntary. I think they are still voluntary. No one's forcing them to hold T-bills. So could they change their mind and do things that, even if they weren't consistent with maximizing returns, they want to do it, they could. And so there is a certain vulnerability to financing this current account deficit. Yes?
Can you make any comparisons between the position, the world position of the U.S. politically and economically today and the Great Britain in decades past?
Sort of when it was the financial center of the universe?
And then strength of the countless reserve currency?
You know, I think I shouldn't make any comparisons because I haven't really tried to do a comparison of those cases. I do, you know, as a casual reader of economics, I see that brought up on occasion. And it's certainly true that if you look back, you know, world economic history, different countries have their moment in the sun. And, you know, I'll just say a lot of people thought our moment in the sun had passed in 1988. A lot of people were pretty sure of that. We'd suffered through two really bad decades, the 70s and 80s. You couldn't pick up Business Week without reading the critique of U.S. economic institutions. We're too short-sighted. We're not patient investors. Too worried about shareholder returns. We've got to be more like Germany and Japan.
The last time around, it was the commercial banks, but the investment banks that caused the problem.
Yeah. But, you know, in the late 80s, when we were reading those stories, I mean, if you had said 20 years from 1988, we're going to be standing here looking back at the last 20 years, knowing what we know now, people would have thought it was preposterous, right? 10 years after 1988, we couldn't invest enough money in companies that were losing it faster than we could give it to them. Talk about patient investors, you know? The internet bubble, right? Sometimes believing is seeing. I don't know. But, you know, I still have faith. Our policies haven't been great. You know, we've gotten ourselves into a corner. We make mistakes. We usually dust ourselves off and do pretty well. The thing that amazes me, you know, I have been reading, since I've been aware of economics, about we have a low saving rate compared to the other countries we were just mentioning, and we have a bad education system. We're no good in math and science. And we don't invest enough. You know, you put all those things together, you'd think after, you know, I mean, this has been true for 30 years or more. You put that together for 30 or 40 years, you'd think things should be pretty bad by now, but they aren't that bad. You know, and to me, some of it's immigration, and some of it is a capital market that, while it just made some big mistakes and played a bit of a fraudulent game with some people, is very good at allocating capital, and we're a country that's very good at rewarding innovation and entrepreneurship. And I think that's kept us going. Now, you know, what may happen is other countries will figure out institutionally these are the advantages, and then the fact that they save more and they're better at math and science is going to become a huge problem. That's kind of my broad brush attempt to say something halfway intelligent about that question. It's nothing to do with the UK. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah, so is the disease the recession and the deficit is a symptom of that? I don't think so. You know, the deficit, we've had a current account deficit for, I mean, more or less 30 years, 40 years, you know, almost every year. Business cycles can add some amplification to it, but I don't think it's really a symptom of that. I think, you know, it's probably more the case that the current account deficit and other things we've seen with saving behavior and house prices, if we tell people enough reasons to be worried about the future, it may make the recession a little worse because people may start trying to save even more for the future, and you know, maybe we need to. You just hope that those transitions are orderly. And you know, so far we seem to have been able to manage an orderly transition. But I wouldn't want Ben Bernanke's job. My goodness, what a challenging period to have to establish your reputation as a Fed chairman. And so far, I think he's done a remarkable job of kind of straddling that. But I don't think the current account is really driven by the softer economy. But the existence of the current account may indeed make the economy softer, if it's part of what worries people about the future. Well, thank you all very much. You have much more up-to-date and in-depth panelists to look forward to in the rest of the conference. But I appreciate the opportunity, as devilish as it was of Charles and Menzie to invite me to have to defend my outlandish views. I enjoy the opportunity. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, everyone. And we are going to...